From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Tar Heels Benoll.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
The Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll look at what's behind the minimum wage debate.
Wages are so low that over 50% of fast food workers in America and their family members have to rely on one or more public assistance programs to make ends meet.
We'll consider the need to establish a real living wage.
I'm not a victim, and I'm not asking for a handout. I just want to provide for my daughter. I want to provide for my family.
Yeah.
What does it really take to make a living in the Bay Area? And what's being done to help people get there?
We put in health insurance. We established a 401k with a 4% match. We have dental insurance, chiropractic, all the sort of things that I never received in 30 years in the restaurant business.
Stay tuned. An extended edition of Cross Currents is next. Income inequality has become a key political issue in the Bay Area and across America. The federal minimum wage has stayed steady at $7.25 an hour since 2009. President Obama addressed this in his State of the Union speech earlier this year.
Today, the federal minimum wage is worth about 20% less than it was when Ronald Reagan first stood here. And Tom Harkin and George Miller have a bill to fix that by lifting the minimum wage to $10.10. It's easy to remember, 10-10. This will help families. It'll give businesses customers with more money to spend. It does not involve any new bureaucratic program. So join the rest of the country. Say yes. Give America a raise.
But Congress has not given America a raise. In California, the minimum wage is $8 an hour, and it's set to rise to $9 on July 1st. But is that enough?
The workers united will never be defeated.
On Thursday, May 15th, walkouts and demonstrations took place in 150 U.S. cities, part of a national campaign among fast food workers to raise the hourly minimum wage to $15 an hour. In Oakland, protesters rallied at a downtown Burger King. In the Bay Area, lawmakers are responding, to some extent. Berkeley's minimum wage will reach $10.75 by 2016. Richmond's will top $12 the following year. Oakland and San Francisco might put wage hike measures before voters in November, but are these increases enough to live on? Many people at a rally in Oakland said they're not even close. Let's hear what they had to say.
My name is Eloise Patton. Nobody can make ends meet on $8 to $9 per hour. Even $10 an hour isn't enough. $12.25 will at least is a great starting point to get income equity for the folks that need it the most.
My name is John Hogue. I am a healthcare worker with ULTCW, United Long-Term Healthcare Workers. And my wages are about $11.50 per hour. It's great wages. However, it's just not quite enough to sustain me. I have to take on a second job to kind of supplement myself where I come up short. I am one of the people that's affected by low wages, like a lot of the other low-wage people in the community. I'm supportive of it because it will help me sustain myself a little easier, a little better. I can get some of the simplicities of life that I can't afford to get at my current rate. Now, I'm sure everybody could use a raise, but this will help the community thrive a little better. If I get sick, I won't have to lose so much money. If my child gets sick, I'll be able to stay home for a while and take care of them without losing too many dollars.
Yeah, my name is Jenna Walashin. I'm a UPS driver in Oakland with Teamsters Local 70. And personally, I make a very nice living wage. In the contract right now, drivers make about $32 an hour. So I can't even imagine what it would be like to try and live off the minimum wage right now. But we do have people, our loaders, start at $8.50 an hour right now. And so it would make a big difference to my coworkers and just the level of morale in our building to have a minimum wage that allowed people to take care of their family with hopefully only working one job. I don't think $12.25 is enough. I know there's the Fight for 15 campaign going across the country, and I think that 15 is a good start. I don't think 15 is enough. I mean, my guess would be it would have to be $20 or more to be adequate. But, I mean, like I said when I was first introducing myself, I mean, I make $32 an hour, and, you know, I'm not even the only wage earner in my family. And so we, you know, it's not like we're, you know, living the high life.
My name is Ebony Young, and I'm a home care worker, and I reside in Oakland. I make $11.50, and it's not enough. More money essentially means, you know, a better life for everybody. You know, I can provide the basic necessities for my daughter. Again, once such as shelter, food. You know, essentially that's what every parent wants, to provide for their children. Making decisions on what to eat at night, whether or not, you know, if I'm eating for three, whether or not to go to McDonald's or spend at a local restaurant to support our community, but have less money during the week. Or decide on, you know, just either to pay rent or to put 10 in the tank and possibly try to get through the next week. You know, it's essentially, you know, I'm not a victim and I'm not asking for a handout. I just want to provide for my daughter. I want to provide for my family.
Those were the voices of Eloise Patton, John Hope, Jenna Woloshin, and Ebony Young. They spoke at one of several rallies that have taken place in the last year. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, and I'm joined now by KALW's Todd Whitney. He's been researching what would go into a real living wage. Thanks for joining us, Todd.
Thanks for having me.
So what did you try to figure out?
I set out to find a real living wage for a family in the Bay Area. So I originally wanted to use data from the 2010 census, but the Bay Area has changed a lot since then. So I ended up using economic projections and national surveys. And what I found was that the average household size in Oakland is about three people.
All right, so that average, that's maybe like a couple and a child?
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I went with. And so I focused on Oakland because it's one of the most rapidly changing communities out here in the Bay Area. And out of the nine counties here, Alameda County is situated right in the middle in terms of income.
All right, so talking averages, what is the average you need to make to live in the Bay Area?
Well, that really depends on where you're at. There are so many variables that there isn't really an average cost of living in the Bay Area at the moment, but that doesn't mean that people aren't thinking about it. I gathered and compared data from four of the most reputable low-wage resources and indexes to figure out the cost of living in the Bay Area.
Well, what are they looking at?
They're considering annual expenses.
All right, so we're talking housing, talking food, transportation.
Yeah, right, all that sort of stuff. And then other basic essentials like healthcare, taxes, childcare, leisure stuff. Now, the funny thing about all that is that some of the indexes come up with completely different results. So we could take MIT, for example. That's one of the indexes that I looked at. MIT says that a family of three worth one working adult and one kid, you need about $44,000 a year to live comfortably.
Okay, so how's it break down? What's the hourly on that?
That means you're pulling in about $21 an hour, one adult, one earner. But that's on the low end projection. On the high end, the Economic Policy Institute says that the same family has to pull in just over $68,000 a year.
That's not even close to what MIT found. It's much higher income.
Yep, I know. We're talking about $33 an hour. Or we can think about it like this. That's two adults earning nearly $17 an hour each.
Well, even at that, that's like twice the national minimum wage. And when you're talking a single wage earner, it's way more. So who's making that kind of money?
On average, people making at least $33 an hour include, you know, your businessmen, computer engineers, architects, nurses.
Well, maybe the better question then is who's not making that kind of money?
Really? That's most jobs out there. Jobs that pay $20 or less an hour, like social service workers, security guards, secretaries, custodians, salespeople.
Well, I'm thinking then restaurant workers then too, right? People working in the food industry?
Absolutely. So of all the people earning an hourly wage in America, about 5% get the minimum wage or less. But like we were just talking about, that's not near enough money to thrive.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Todd.
Thanks for having me.
That's KALW's Todd Whitney. This is an extended edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. Today, we're looking at the costs, benefits, and challenges of creating a real living wage. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, San Francisco passed a variety of measures to help low-wage workers try to keep up with the rising cost of living. The city now has the highest minimum wage in the country at $10.74 an hour. It also requires employers to either provide health benefits or pay into a pool so the city can cover their health care costs. So how has this worked out for workers and their employers? Ken Jacobs has been studying those questions for over a decade. He's chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. Our reporter Todd Whitney invited Jacobs on a driving tour around some of San Francisco's restaurants to get an on-the-scene sense of wage issues. They started their journey at the south end of Mission Street.
What, if anything, would raising the minimum wage do to mitigate income inequality in America and in the Bay Area in particular?
So what's happened in this economy, as we've had such strong growth in income at the top, we've had stagnating and declining wages at the bottom. And the minimum wage does a very good job of reaching about the bottom 10% of the workforce. So overall, in the last 10 years since San Francisco's minimum wage law went into effect, we estimate over $1.2 billion have gone into the pockets of low-wage workers in San Francisco. One of the big questions was, what's it meant for employment? Whenever these laws are proposed, what you hear is, it'll be a job killer. And as it turns out, when you look in San Francisco, employment has grown about the same pace, a little bit faster than the rest of the Bay Area over this time period. And when you look at restaurant employment, it's actually grown faster. So there isn't any evidence of job loss as a result of these laws. And so then you ask yourself, okay, if we're not seeing a reduction in jobs, how are employers absorbing these costs? What is happening? What you do see is a notable decline in turnover. Workers are staying on the job longer. And you also see a small increase in price. Because the law applies to everybody, restaurants have raised their prices. So they went up 2.8%. So 2.8% increase in restaurant costs. So you're basically talking about a dime to a burrito, maybe a little bit more, somewhere in that range. So for a restaurant like that, it's a really small price increase for the customers, but it adds up to quite a bit for the workers and very meaningful for them in terms of their own ability to get by and survive in a city as expensive as this one.
All right. So we just pulled up to our first stop. We're at a little taqueria joint called Taqueria Menudo in the Excelsior District. I'm here with Ken Jacobs, head of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. And we're talking about what the impact of having the highest minimum wage in the country has had on San Francisco businesses like this one. So, Ken, what'd you find?
In limited service restaurants like this, we found an increase in worker tenure. People were staying on the job longer, and that saves money for restaurants as well in terms of hiring and recruiting costs, improves productivity and customer service. So they get some savings there. But the larger thing is they are absorbing it through a little bit higher prices. And so for the workers, it means a pretty substantial increase in terms of what they need to get through. We did see a small increase in prices. Again, restaurants raised their prices by about 2.8% compared to similar restaurants in Alameda County during the same time period. So you've got a small increase in price as a way to absorb the costs. Generally, also in limited service restaurants like this, we found an increase in worker tenure. People were staying on the job longer, and that saves money for restaurants as well in terms of hiring and recruiting costs.
All right, so you found that paying workers more at your average San Francisco burrito joint can actually work out better for employers in the long run. All right, so we're going to make some moves over to a different part of the Mission District, and we're going to see how restaurants over there compare. San Francisco is one of the first cities in America to institute a lot of these, raising the minimum wage and offering more benefits like sick leave to workers, to low-wage workers. What were some of the things that led San Francisco to do that in the first place?
Well, some of the same conditions we're seeing today. If we remember in the late 90s, rents were going up very highly and very quickly in San Francisco. Cost of living was high. We were seeing people being displaced. And so there was a lot of concern going on around the issues of low-wage work and people's ability to survive and support their families on what they earn. And that was also part of a movement that was happening across the United States as municipalities were taking into their own hands doing measures to improve wages and working conditions, given the lack of action on the federal level. So throughout the Bay Area and California, cities are looking at doing their own efforts to raise the minimum wage. Oakland has a proposal, Berkeley, Richmond, San Diego. So I think we're going to see quite a few cities looking at and doing some of the things that San Francisco has done.
All right, so we pulled up to a McDonald's at the corner of 24th and Mission. I'm here with Ken Jacobs, the head of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. We're going to head inside and talk about wage issues as they apply to fast food chains in the Bay Area. So, Ken, what exactly is the situation for people working your average fast food job?
If we look nationally at fast food restaurants, wages are so low that over 50% of fast food workers in America and their family members have to rely on one or more public assistance programs to make ends meet. So when we look at Medicaid, food stamps, the Earned Income Tax Credit, TANF, Temporary Aid for Needy Families, those programs are being widely used by fast food workers because the pay is so low that that's what they need to make it through the month. Because the pay is so low and people often work low hours, they don't earn enough to survive and support their families on their own. But when we looked at fast food workers, even those who work full-time in the United States, more than half of their families rely on some form of public assistance.
And what are the operating costs that go into your average restaurant in the Bay Area? First, a restaurant like a McDonald's. What would be the operating cost of a place like this?
So the operating cost, labor is going to be about a third of the costs. And then you have food, rent, and all the supplies and equipment. When we look at fast food restaurants, many of them are franchises. And so there's sort of two ways to look at this. Some of them can be owned by the corporation themselves. McDonald's has had incredible profits in recent years. There are some restaurants that are owned by investors or firms that own multiple franchises. And then there are some fast food restaurants that are owned by a single individual that's operating it like a small business. Now, any franchise owner, they have to pay, one of their biggest part of their operating costs is the franchise fee, which they pay to the corporation every month that allows them to be a McDonald's. They're also buying their supplies from the company. And the franchise owners, when the small franchise owners, are really squeezed in this operation. So their ability on their own to raise wages can be difficult because the corporation has an amount that it expects to be paid and required to be paid on a regular basis from the franchise owner. And where the real heavy profits are at the top on the level of the corporation. And the fast food industry nationally last year had $7 billion in profits, which is about the same as the $7 billion that we estimate fast food workers and their families used in public assistance.
And is there any sort of distinction between a limited service restaurant and a McDonald's when the business model in terms of being able to handle a hike in the minimum wage?
Well, again, when you look at something like McDonald's, there are different fast food restaurants come in different flavors in the sense of we've got some that are owned by the corporation themselves, some that are owned by large investment groups, and some that are owned by an individual owner. The ones that are owned by an individual owner really are much more like a small business, but they have less variability in terms of their ability to say, here, I'm going to change change sourcers for where I buy my food, or change what product, where I'm getting my napkins or other kinds of things, because the rules are set from the top. And so ultimately, if we're going to see a big raise in wages in the fast food restaurants, McDonald's and the big companies are going to have to step up to the plate and deal with that in franchise fees. That said, In-N-Out Burger has always paid higher wages. That's built into their model. They do quite well. They're quite productive. Their workers earn a lot more, and they're making money. So you can do a fast food model that involves better wages than are paid in most fast food restaurants in the United States.
That's Ken Jacobs, head of the UC Berkeley Labor Center. And we're talking about the impact of raising pay for low-wage workers here in the Bay Area. All right, we're going to head back out. we've got one more kind of restaurant to consider. So now we've arrived at 18th and Guerrero. It's a neighborhood with lots of mid to high priced restaurants, lots of boutique clothing shops, people whipping around on their fixies outside. So this part of the Mission, Ken, is definitely one of the trendiest in the city.
So when you stand in this part of the Mission, it's hard to remember that as late as 1989, the median wage in San Francisco was lower than the average for the state of California. We have seen tremendous change in San Francisco as more and more the tech industry boomed and more people with money have moved into the city. And so one of the big questions has been, as people do come into the city and have more money, there are service jobs created to serve those people, right? So the restaurant industry is one area that people patronize who work in the tech industry. And the big question is always, okay, if we've got these low-wage service jobs that are coming up to serve all the people who are coming in who have a bit more money, what do those jobs pay? And one of the important things about San Francisco's labor standards policies, the living wage law, health care law, paid sick leave, is to ensure that the new jobs that are being created actually are jobs that pay decent wages and provide people with the benefits they need.
So in your work with the UC Berkeley Labor Center, you've highlighted some of the restaurants that have really gone out of their way to do right by their workers. Can you tell us about some of those restaurants and what exactly it is that they're doing that makes them different?
Well, sure. So when San Francisco passed the Healthcare Security Ordinance, went into effect in 2007, and that requires businesses to meet a minimum spending standard for workers' health care. So there are restaurants like Zazie in Coal Valley that gave their full-time workers Kaiser, good health plan. They're happy with it. The workers are happy with it. They found it's made a real difference. And in fact, there's been a whole series of issues here. When the law was passed, restaurants who didn't like it decided to put surcharges on their menus to tell everybody, hey, when you this extra 3% or 4% is paying for the healthcare requirement, which what happened was many of the diners were happy to do that. I don't mind paying a little more on my restaurant bill to know the worker has healthcare. But then it turned out some of those restaurants were just pocketing the money and weren't really giving it to the workers healthcare. I want to emphasize, most businesses in San Francisco are providing workers good health benefits. And in fact, we saw a good uptick in workers with health benefits from their employer in San Francisco as a result of the law, even as it's been declining in the rest of the country. But there's always a few who try to figure out a way around it and get away with doing as little as possible.
We just took a tour of San Francisco's Mission Street with Ken Jacobs, chair of the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education. He spoke with KALW's Todd Whitney. Jacobs recently co-wrote the book, When Mandates Work, about the impact of San Francisco's labor laws. You can find a link to that, along with an archive of today's and all of our shows, at KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. We just heard briefly about a restaurant that's found a way to pay its workers a real living wage right in the middle of San Francisco. It's Zazie in Coal Valley, near the east end of Golden Gate Park. Let's go there now to see how they do it.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Good. Do you need a couple more minutes or have any questions about the menu?
My name is Jennifer Piala, and I'm the owner of Zazie Restaurant in Coal Valley.
Double latte?
We have a lot of Southern-style dishes, Southern French dishes, the kind of food that you would cook at home if you had 4 or 5 hours to cook during the day. I've really enjoyed ownership. I found it to be a really interesting experience, especially because I had done everything else. I had worked everywhere from dishwasher to, you know, waitress, bartender. I trained as a pastry chef, worked in kitchens, managed. And during that time, you sort of develop a laundry list of things that you would do differently if you were the owner, a list of things that you wish that people saw in a different light. And so when I bought it, it was wonderful to be able to incorporate a lot of those things.
We put in health insurance. We established a 401k with a 4% match. We have dental insurance, chiropractic, all the sort of things that I never received in 30 years in the restaurant business. All of that comes from the $1.25 per person surcharge, which is on our bill. And that $1.25 per person actually covers all of our costs for, you know, well, last year I think we ran up $13,000 short. But considering our health insurance is $120,000, the 401k costs $60,000 a year, you know, there's a lot of things that that $125 covers. It's pretty incredible. And because of that, my staff just stays. I mean, the waitress that you talked today, Sarah Jane, has been with me for 9 years. Ernan there has been with me for 7 years. Kitchen staff, I haven't hired anyone in over 6 years. I worked with a restaurant consulting group when I first bought the restaurant called AOCSF, and they had 900 restaurants in San Francisco in their group. And doing analysis of my numbers, one of the things that they realized was that I had the highest labor costs and the highest profit among those 900 restaurants, and the lowest food cost and the lowest loss. Billy Baldo, who just left, you just saw him leave. He's been with me for 10 years now. And we had health insurance for about 6 months when he developed appendicitis. And he called me up and said, Patrona, I can't come to work. And he's never called in sick the entire time. And I said, what's wrong? He said, my stomach hurts so bad I can't even walk. I said, okay, I'm going to come get you, and we're going to go to the hospital. At the end of, you know, he was operated on, everything. I went back to get him like 2 days later. And we get down to the office, and they're giving him back his valuables. And they're like, one wedding ring, one crucifix, and one wallet with $18,496. And I'm like, Billy, why did you bring $18,000 to the hospital? He said, well, I just assumed I'd have to pay for it. And they were like, well, you do have to pay. It's $10 copay. We need $10. And he just couldn't believe it. He was so amazed. He had put off going to the hospital, put off calling me so that he could get as much cash from as many friends as he could, assuming that this meant that he was going to have to, you know, that this card wasn't really going to do anything. And that was such an incredible experience to see his pleasure and his joy at actually having health insurance.
All right, so what are we thinking here?
Can I get the poached eggs, Albert, please?
Mm-hmm. And my motivation is twofold. I give people a living wage and want to give them a living wage and make their lives livable, including health insurance and that sort of thing. For personal reasons, for emotional reasons, that I can't imagine living as good a life as I do while the people that are actually making the money for me suffer and live six people to a studio apartment and are too afraid to go to the hospital because they have appendicitis and all of that sort of thing. I just morally couldn't do it. I was raised better than that. Secondly, it's financial and security-wise, just knowing that these people are watching out for me and they're watching out for my restaurant. I don't need to worry about this place when I'm away. I don't think it's hard to replicate. I think that there's a loss among restaurant owners in particular of the golden rule, of the idea that how you treat people, they will return it to you. People are always trying to sell you things like security systems and computer systems and devices that will allow you to watch and track your employees. And the idea is to prevent employee theft. The only thing that will prevent employee theft is making them not want to steal from you and making them want to tell if someone else is. It's not only morally the right thing to do to take care of your employees, it's financially the right thing to do.
That's Jennifer Pialat, owner of Zazi, a restaurant in San Francisco. Pialat has testified before the U.S. Department of Labor about the need to provide hourly workers with health care, paid sick leave, and schedule flexibility. Now, it should be noted that Zazi is a very popular restaurant, and has been for years. When you've regularly got crowds out the door, it's easier to play with your profit margin. But the restaurant industry overall is tough for business. Hard numbers are hard to find, but a widely cited academic study shows 3 out of 5 restaurants nationwide close or change ownership within 3 years of opening. We asked the Oakland Chamber of Commerce to weigh in on this wage discussion. They didn't. San Francisco has refused as well. They say they're working behind closed doors with politicians and so-called stakeholders to develop what they call consensus measures on the minimum wage issue that voters can consider in November. Even if the minimum wage rises to $15 an hour, more than twice the national rate, it will still be too little to cover costs in the Bay Area. so many people will continue to work for less money than they can afford to live on. People like 24-year-old Dawana Stewart. She's a native San Franciscan, graduated from June Jordan School for Equity, a small high school on the southeast side of the city. She shares a home with her mother. It's the only way she's been able to stay in San Francisco. We spent a week with Dawana to get a sense of her life living on the minimum wage.
All right, here you are in a size 9.
Mm-hmm. This one is a little bit too narrow.
Okay, so yeah, that's why I wanted to bring out the 9, just so you can test it out and see which size you prefer.
My name is Dawana Stewart. I live in Bayview, Hunters Point, San Francisco, California.
But I also want to see how it fits as a 9, just see if it's too big or if it's too loose.
My primary job is working at Macy's Union Square as a shoes associate. That's the job I've had for about 4 or 5 years. I've kept this job for so long because, one, I work on commission, so that's a little extra change on top of my minimum wage. My second job is a teacher at June Jordan School for Equity to, you know, basically help children try to make movies and flex their creative muscles.
So let's get Jason. Can we get the camera out? Can we get Omar?
The third job I have, I recently just obtained as a production assistant for ABC Productions. So basically what we're doing, we're filming teachers at June Jordan currently.
Okay, Martha, can you help out too? Can we get a couple of chairs? Just two chairs each, please.
The Macy's pays me every Friday, so that runs between like $150 to maybe like $240 maybe a week. For June Jordan, I get paid a stipend of $2,000 at the end of each semester. For ABC Productions, I get paid every Monday, but for some reason, we're having trouble receiving our checks on a weekly basis. So some people are receiving the checks more later than they would want to, and that's kind of sucks because it's like when you're behind on payment, then people can't seem to, you know, pay their bills or get their rent done on time. So it's when the checks are late, then it makes everybody else late too. So my mom's a single parent, so it's always just been me and her because I'm her only child.
But I would think, okay, well, now if they're having the construction in the house like now.
Yeah, but you know they're not putting no money in the house. I've told the contractor who's been fixing the house that's a problem. Family doesn't want to spend any money.
My income on my own without being dependent on my mom isn't like super bad to afford to live in the city, but I would still have to find a place and potential roommates. Earlier during 2012, I was actually trying to apply for low-income housing. However, that year that I started applying was the same year that my mom started charging me for rent. So the money that I wanted to go towards getting an apartment really just went straight to my mom, which kind of like threw a monkey wrench into my overall plans of trying to find a place of my own.
Was it the number 9 three-piece?
You want a meal or just
the just the strips and then the satisfies.
I spoil myself with food. I love food, all types of food. During a week, I might pay like $150 to $200 on food. And we're not even talking about meals. We're talking about like, oh, let me get a tea, and let me get like a yogurt, and maybe I'll get a water, and then maybe I'll get lunch. And then so after a while, it all starts piling up. It's unhealthy, but it is what it is.
28.
Thank you. So for entertainment, like I haven't seen a movie in so long, so I couldn't tell you how much I would spend on that. But for fun purposes, usually fun is free, so I don't spend too much money on that. Hopping on the bus and not paying and hoping and praying the Muni police do not get on the bus. that's one strategy. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but sometimes a free mini ride, hey.
at the time. So that $75 ticket, man, that's a doozy. My cell phone bill, it's always 60 to 70 a month. I'm bad at paying off my card on time. I just made like a big lump sum payment, like of $300. But on average, I'll pay like the minimum of like 25 to 50. I mean, at 24, you would think, oh, I have my own car, I have my own place, I'm, like, you know, really independent and living in the city. So you would think I'll be making my own moves right now. When my mom was at this age, she moved out at 18, and I think she had, like, her own apartment by the time she was, like, 21. So definitely like to be further ahead in my life. Even though I'm, like, it seems like I'm doing so much, I still would like to be, like, a lot further ahead than where I am now.
That story was produced by KALW's Jasmine Lopez. Now we'd like to hear from you. Are you an employee? An employer? What can be done to make sure everybody makes a living wage? Call our tip line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Share your thoughts, and you may hear yourself on the air. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. Today's show is produced by Todd Whitney. It was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Liz Mack, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Rachel Wong. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Chien. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Cross Currents theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported public radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.